Audio Journal is a radio reading service intended for a print-impaired audience. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
Hello, all you Audio Journal Sports Page fans. This is Anna, and along with Nick and Chris, we would like to welcome you to another edition of Audio Journal Sports Page. This is a program by, for, and about sports, activities, adventure, and information involving people with a variety of disabilities. Okay, I'm going to start off my segment here with an article that caught my eye. It speaks about football, but this article is from across the pond, which their football is soccer to us. But anyway, here goes. I experienced football as a blind fan. It was harder than I ever imagined. Glasses, telescopes, and the power of crowd noise, my day at Wigan Athletic taught me how technology holds the key for fans registered blind and proved football must do better. Last Saturday, I went to Wigan Athletic for a match experience with a difference. Matt Harrison is a Wigan supporter who, at the age of 32, was diagnosed with Stargardt's disease, a macular dystrophy that starts with blurred vision and blind spots. It progressed to the point that Matt's sight loss became extreme. He jokes that the last Wigan goal he saw as Ben Watson's winner in the 2013 FA Cup final, and the honesty catches me off guard. Nice to go out with a bang, eh? I wanted to shadow Matt for the day to better understand the experience of being registered blind at football matches, the tools that are designed to help him, and the ways in which football can and surely must improve. These are the things that I learned from one of the most fascinating days I have spent in a football stadium. I'm in awe of Matt's dedication. After we met by the statue of Dave Whalen, Matt explains that this is a doubleheader weekend. He, his wife, two children, and mom are attending today's home match, staying over and then going to the women's game on Sunday. He lives in Nottingham, and the family travel up and down the country for these matches. Football, Matt said, was a large part of his everything. He met friends, found a wider family, and bonded with strangers. When a scary diagnosis came, he was determined not to let his world shrink even further. But it's hard. Matt remembers what football looked like, and that must be difficult to process. Football stadiums, particularly those that are unfamiliar and ancient, are not designed for those without sight to explore easily. So when Matt talks of a doubleheader and ticking off new grounds, I'm in awe, and I hope that doesn't sound patronizing. Football supporters are great, and he is better than most. Put yourself in someone else's reality. Walk a mile in someone else's shoes. For Wigan versus Mansfield, Matt has provided me with glasses that convey his exact sight loss profile. Large black areas in the center of vision, and then deep blurring around them. Matt also struggles with certain colors appearing the same and depth perception, things that cannot be adequately replicated. He uses a small telescope device held up to his left eye, which has slightly better vision than his right, to get a clearer view of the ball. The small field of vision means that when a pass is played forward, he scans to the penalty area and waits for a chance to give himself the best chance of seeing a goal. Pathetically obvious statement. It is nearly impossible for me. I can follow some of the sideways and backwards passing, but as soon as the next move becomes unpredictable, I am lost. The exception, pleasingly, is Wiggins' winner. A penalty allows me to gain some focus on the ball and see which way it is aimed. You really need to know the audio description. To assist Matt, me, today, and other visually impaired supporters, football clubs have audio commentary in headsets. These are split into two forms, general match commentary and audio description commentary. There is a crucial difference, as Matt is keen to reinforce. Radio commentary, which he loves at home, offers insight on the action. Audio description, most helpful for blind supporters, provides a frame of reference. Matt needs to know where the ball is on the pitch. The old grid system, back to square one, was actually very useful. He needs to know where passes have been directed. Good radio commentary contains deliberate periods of silence, but for Matt and others, when he's at the match, silence is darkness. At Wigan, I don't find the commentary helpful enough. Everyone is trying their best, but it's certainly not an ideal audio description. You hear random words uttered alone, bodies, chants, movement, and have no context for what they represent visually. It is frustrating, and I am only playing at this one afternoon. Every club should have to provide it. The audio commentary occasionally cuts out and dips in volume. Matt's batteries run out. It would be nice if fully recharged ones were used to avoid missing a couple of minutes, but replacements are at least included in the pouch. And at least Wigan actually provide audio headsets with commentary. I can't quite believe it when he tells me, probably my own privilege showing, but there are football league clubs that do not offer the service. Matt has been in away ends behind the goal, and so basically unable to follow the action at the opposite end, with nothing to assist him. Given the money required to implement it and the money wasted across other areas of the club, that is a scandal that must be addressed. Every professional football club in England must provide a full audio description commentary as part of their charter to have their license approved. The crowd noise helps. After the first 20 minutes, I am struggling to create any mental picture at all of what is happening in front of me. My brain begins to use other information that is usually football white noise. Matt told me that this would happen. The referee's whistle helps. Obviously, it signals a break in play, but the severity of or repetition of the sound can indicate that severity of a challenge or a melee between multiple players. The crowd helps more. A jeer indicates that misplaced pass or shot has missed its target by some distance. There's a specific type of applause for passing move, defensive certainty or failed attempt. Certain subconscious shouts, man on, offside, play it, pressure him, create synaptic links and produce small windows of context. Technology holds the key to improvement. If the present is audio description where provided, the future is far more ambitious and optimistic. Crystal Palace and Dundee United have trialed technology that provides a headset to stream match footage in real time with no latency issues. From that, that would provide a clearer picture with the real-life sound of the match in sync with his view. Japan has also developed an AI power tool known as AI Suitcase, which uses a tracker in the ball and vibrates to tell the visually impaired supporters where the ball is on pitch. It was trialed during the regular NFL season in 2025 and offered a number of blind supporters at the Super Bowl the chance to absorb the game differently. Either or both would be welcomed by Matt and others. There are possibilities to supercharge the experience. Inevitably, these would occur at elite clubs first, but there is no reason why the 5G network can't be strong enough in every ground to avoid delay issues with headset streaming. So yes, technology is catching up so everyone can enjoy sports. Okay, my next article is titled, Adaptive Scuba Diving Gives Veterans New Hope. For VA recreational therapist Charlie Wright, healing doesn't always take place in the clinic. Sometimes it happens on a boat, where Charlie and a growing network of volunteer divers help countless veterans and wounded warriors rediscover peace, joy, and healing underwater. Here, he shares his story with Women's World. Would you like to go scuba diving? Charlie Wright asked Phil, a quadriplegic in the spinal cord unit of Arizona Hospital where Charlie worked. Are you kidding me? Asked Phil. No, I'm not, Charlie said. And then he explained exactly how it would work. Charlie had recently graduated as a recreational therapist, but he also had another passion, scuba diving. And he'd follow that passion all the way to becoming a fully certified dive instructor. It wasn't long before the two worlds began to merge. It began when a friend of a friend told Charlie about his son, Nello Tanner, who has Down syndrome. He's always been fascinated by sharks, Nello's dad explained. It's always been his dream to do a shark dive. Let's make that happen, Charlie offered without hesitation. A Phoenix dive shop opened their facilities to Charlie, and he began training Nello and his parents to receive a dive certification so they could visit the undersea world anytime. This is a dream come true, Nello said, after spending a few days diving with gentle nurse sharks on a dive trip he took with his parents. Nello's excitement lit a fire under Charlie. He couldn't wait to offer underwater freedoms to others who never imagined it to be possible for them. A new dream. Now for Phil, Charlie knew he would need a team of buddies with medical expertise. He recruited therapists, doctors, and nurses and certified all of them to dive. Then the entire group headed to Mexico, where Charlie and the others gently lowered Phil into the water for several sessions amid a group of playful harbor seals. When they hoisted Phil back onto the boat, his face was radiant. I felt more relaxed than I have in years, he said. The whole dive was incredible. Soon after, Charlie moved to St. Louis to work as a VA recreational therapist. He also brought along his dive equipment, and soon he was setting up a nonprofit, Life Waters, and used his credit card to buy enough equipment to get his foundation off the ground. The VA allowed Charlie to use their therapeutic pool to offer lessons to veterans with injuries and PTSD. He also trained their family members so they can continue adaptive diving together using borrowed Life Waters gear. No words can describe how much freedom there is below the waves, said USMC paraplegic Hack Albertson. Many others echo his sentiment. Hope restored underwater. Today, Life Waters has grown into a coast-to-coast network of volunteer instructors and dive bodies, along with the entire building full of equipment that divers and their families can borrow. Charlie even created the Hero Dive Project for persons with ALS. Getting back into the water keeps me going, says Air Force veteran Bill Chase. I feel like my old self again under the water. According to Charlie, the weightlessness of the underwater world offers a fun escape from daily struggles and chance to feel old again. Old, feel whole again. It helps reduce anxiety, depression, and pain while boosting self-confidence and social connection, he says. We focus on abilities and work around the limitations. It's a real joy using something I love as much as scuba diving to help so many others. What a great story. Love it. Next up is veterans find healing through outdoor adventures. I just wanted to end up off the grid, up the hills, says Misha Pemble Belkin, SSG U.S. retired. In 2015, Pemble Belkin was 26 and really struggling. He'd taken a medical retirement 5 months into his second development to Kunar Province, Afghanistan. In August of that year, his unit had been a direct engagement with Taliban fighters. A blast left Pemble Belkin with a cervical spine injury and traumatic brain injury. With their kids in tow, he and his wife moved to Vermont. There he got in touch with local VA, but felt overwhelmed by all the therapies they recommended. Then a peer counselor learned that Pemble Belkin had loved snowboarding as a kid. The counselor suggested the vet check out a program called Vermont Adaptive. The nonprofit helps youths and adults with disabilities participate in a range of outdoor activities, including skiing, snowboarding, and other sports. For Pemble Belkin, it was a lifesaver. On his first visit to the program, they let me stand in the corner, he said. He kept coming back and realized he was beginning to feel better. He enrolled in college and started volunteering with Vermont Adaptive. In 2017, needing to fulfill a college credit, he became an intern. While Vermont Adaptive had been around since 1987, their veteran program was still new. It wasn't even named, said Pemble Belkin. That first year, he doubled programs offered by two veterans. By 2020, he had been hired full-time to lead Vermont Adaptive's Veteran Ventures program. Under Pemble Belkin's direction, Veteran Ventures program has hosted 734 individual veterans who have taken part in a total of 9,960 activities, he said. They've also hosted 41 multi-day retreats. All activities are 100% free to veterans. Pemble Belkin says he's laser-focused on finding the right fit for each participant, developing programs like equine therapy, ice and rock climbing, mountain biking, skiing, boarding, apple picking, bowling, and dozens of retreats. The goal, he says, is to get veterans outside so they can experience the physical and mental benefits of outdoor recreation. This past February, he took 10 veterans for a 3-day backcountry trip to Mount Washington's Tuckerman Ravine, the birthplace of extreme skiing. Vermont Adaptive has outposts at Vermont's Sugar Bush and Pico Resorts. They also work with other ski areas in the state, including Stratton Mountain Resort, Bromley Mountain Ski Resort, Bolton Valley, and Saskadina 6, as well as the national initiatives such as Move United. But veterans don't have to be a part of a group to participate. Anyone can apply on the Vermont Adaptive website to come as an individual. Utah programs. West Coast vets have options as well. On the other side of the country, in the Rocky Mountains, the National Ability Center in Park City, Utah, has been creating programs for veterans since 1985. If you're a thrill seeker, you can come and you can ski and mountain bike. If it's the first time you left the house in 2 years because of PTSD, you can come and you can feel safe. It's really cool to see a group of veterans come from across the country who don't know each other. The first day, it's pretty quiet. And by the end of that week, they're making plans to get together again. So these programs work, and they're just incredible for anyone to do. Now, something in our own backyard. Guys, you know I always hail the benefits of all-out adventures right in our area, in the New England area. I've done biking, I've done kayaking, I've done ice skating. There's hiking, there's snowshoeing. They have just so many different things that we can take part in. So if you'd like some information to maybe get going in our area, that would be, you go to alloutadventures.org. They have everything listed there. And if you're not in the area I'm speaking of, which is the New England area, just do a Google search and check out maybe something like adaptive sports. I'm sure something would come up. Hey, even here we have adaptive rock climbing at Central Mass Rock Gym in Worcester. So there's something for everybody here. Let's get out and have a great time. All right, looks like I used all my time here on Audio Journal Sports Page, so I'm going to hand it over to the guys. Take it over, guys. Can't see or hear what you have to talk about today.
Thanks, Hannah. Hi, everyone. This is Nick, and I'll be reading you a few stories here for this week's edition of AJ Sports. The first article is from DraftCountdown.com, and it's entitled Designing Visually Inclusive Casino Interfaces for Colorblind and Visually Impaired Players. Statistics show that roughly 1 in 12 men and 1 in 200 women experience some form of color vision deficiency. For a designer, this isn't just a niche demographic. It represents a significant portion of the audience that might be struggling to distinguish a win from a loss, or a deposit button from a cancel one. Moving away from purely aesthetic choices toward inclusive design isn't just about being helpful. It is about ensuring that the thrill of the game is accessible to everyone, regardless of how they perceive the world. The foundation of accessible sight. The most common mistake in interface design is relying solely on color to convey information. For someone with protanopia or durantanopia, red-green color blindness, a red stop button and a green go button might look identical. To build a truly inclusive environment, developers must move toward a multimodal approach where color is supported by other visual cues. The power of shape and pattern. When color fails, shape succeeds. In high-quality interface design, buttons should never be distinguished by hue alone. Instead, developers are beginning to use iconography, adding a distinct X or check mark inside buttons so the function is clear even in grayscale, textured backgrounds, using subtle stripes or dots to differentiate between different sections of a game board, and border weight, using thicker or glowing borders to indicate an active selection. Enhancing interaction through contrast. Contrast is the unsung hero of user experience. For players with low vision or blurred vision, the relationship between the foreground and background determines whether a game is playable or exhausting. Inclusive interfaces prioritize high contrast ratios, ensuring that text stands out sharply against the background. This is especially important in the fast-moving world of online gaming, where information needs to be processed in a split second. Modern gaming software is becoming more sophisticated in how it handles these visual demands. As games become more feature-rich, the UI must remain clean. For example, many players today seek out the immediate action of bonus buy slots, which allow for direct access to a game's most exciting features. Because these games often have complex menus and various purchasing options, the design must be impeccable. Clear, high-contrast labels and distinct button shapes ensure that a player can navigate these features confidently knowing exactly what they are clicking without needing to strain their eyes or second-guess a color shade. Typography as a navigation tool. Font choice is another critical pillar. Script fonts or overly stylized lettering might look on theme for a pirate or ancient Egyptian game, but they are often a nightmare for visually impaired users. Inclusive design favors sans serif fonts. These are generally easier to read on screens because they lack the small decorative flourishes of serif fonts. Adjustable text sizes, allowing users to scale the UI so that labels are large enough to read comfortably. Letter spacing, ensuring characters don't smush together, which can cause confusion for those with certain types of visual impairment. The testing phase, seeing through different eyes. You cannot build an inclusive interface without testing it under different conditions. Developers are now using sophisticated software filters that allow them to see their designs exactly as a colorblind person would. This empathy testing reveals hidden flaws, such as a map where two different territories look identical, or a payout table where the gold and silver symbols are indistinguishable. A design cheat sheet for inclusion. To ensure a project meets the needs of all players, designers must often follow a specific checklist during the development process. Avoid certain pairings. Never rely on red, green, or blue-purple combinations for critical information. Implement dark mode. This can significantly reduce eye strain for many users and provide better contrast for those with light sensitivity. Use tool tips. When a mouse or finger hovers over a button, a text description should appear to confirm the button's purpose. Logical focus order. For those using screen readers or keyboard navigation, the interface should move in a logical, predictable pattern from top to bottom and left to right. The universal benefit of better design. When we design for the visually impaired, we aren't just helping a specific group. We are making the experience better for everyone. Think about a player trying to see their screen in bright Canadian sunlight or someone playing on a small mobile device while on the bus. The high contrast, clear icons, and readable fonts that help a colorblind player are the same features that make the game more enjoyable for a person in a suboptimal viewing environment. Inclusive design is a move toward a more thoughtful, human-centric way of building software. It acknowledges that the average user is a myth and that our tools should be flexible enough to meet people where they are. By stripping away the reliance on color and focusing on clarity, shape, and contrast, developers create a space where the only thing a player needs to focus on is the fun itself. The future of the industry isn't just about more pixels or faster animations. It's about making sure that every player, regardless of their vision, has a seat at the table. The next article I would like to read tonight is from the nationaltribune.com.au. PolyU School of Optometry and China-Hong Kong Paralympic Committee sign MOU to advance para-sports development and support vision impairment classification for athletes. The School for Optometry at the Hong Kong Polytechnic University, PolyU, and the China-Hong Kong Paralympic Committee, HKPC, signed a Memorandum of Understanding, MOU, on the 5th of June. The two parties will leverage their respective strengths, combining academic research expertise with sports resources, to foster the long-term development of Hong Kong's para-sports ecosystem, We're providing comprehensive and professional support for para-athletes, coaches, and practitioners. The School of Optometry at the Hong Kong Polytechnic University, witnessed by Professor David Shung, Dean of the PolyU Faculty of Health and Social Sciences, and Mrs. Jenny Fung, President of China-Hong Kong Paralympic Committee, the MOU was signed by Professor Ki Chi Hu, Head and Professor of the PolyU School of Optometry, and Dr. Jim Luke, Vice President of China-Hong Kong Paralympic Committee. The PolyU School of Optometry will engage in deep cooperation with HKPC across four key areas: facilitating vision impairment classification. Vision classification is essential for ensuring fair competition in para sports. The PolyU School of Optometry will utilize its professional optometric expertise to assist visually impaired athletes in completing precise vision impairment classifications according to their specific sports. Providing professional training and support, PolyU will deploy an expert team to provide academic expertise and professional support for seminars, workshops, and coaching courses organized by HKPC, while HKPC will facilitate connections with athletes, coaches, and para sports resources, thereby building a practical exchange platform. Promoting joint research and educational initiatives, both parties will explore joint research projects, educational initiatives, and development programs aiming to enhance training effectiveness and the eye health of para-athletes. Fostering international collaboration and exchanges, both parties will jointly explore international collaboration opportunities to promote academic and technical exchanges between local and overseas para-sports organizations. Professor Ki Chi Su said, "This meaningful collaboration will help translate the PolyU School of Optometry's world-class clinical expertise and research outcomes into a broader social impact. Not only will it showcase the school's excellence in optometric specialties on the international sports stage, but it will also strengthen our clinical research and training in the specialized field of vision impairment. By providing precise standard-setting classifications and scientific support, we look forward to contributing to the professionalization of para sports while further demonstrating our school's leadership in global optometric care," Dr. Luke stated. Fair competition in para sports relies heavily on scientific classification, with vision classification carrying the highest technical threshold. This partnership holds profound significance for the long-term development of para sports in Hong Kong. We look forward to working closely with PolyU to achieve fruitful outcomes in classification, professional training, joint research, and international exchanges, driving the professionalization of local sports. Looking ahead, both parties hope to harness this collaboration to unlock new opportunities for Hong Kong's para sports community and jointly promote the popularization and professionalization of sports locally. The next article I'd like to read is from IBSASport.org, entitled "A Historic Milestone: IBSA Opens the First Equipment Certification Case in Its History." The International Blind Sports Federation, IBSA, has reached a historic milestone with the launch of its equipment standardization, certification, and future licensing system, and the opening of the first equipment certification case in the Federation's history. For the first time since its establishment in 1981, IBSA has created a structured international framework governing the standardization, certification, and future licensing of sports equipment used in official blind sports competitions. This initiative forms part of IBSA's broader commitment to athlete safety, competition integrity, equipment quality, and good governance across all areas of blind sports. Over recent months, the IBSA Executive Board approved the overall concept, regulatory framework, implementation model, and technical standards required for the pilot phase of the project. Comprehensive standards have now been developed and approved for goalball and blind football following extensive consultations with their respective sport committees, technical experts, and industry stakeholders. One of the most significant achievements of the project has been the opening of the first certification case in IBSA history. The opening of the first certification case marks the formal launch of the IBSA certification system in practice and represents the transition of the project from policy development to operational implementation. KSG Kiliak Spezialeckertol aus Gummi, Germany, manufacturer of internationally recognized WV Goalball product, has become the first manufacturer in IBSA history to formally participate in the new certification process. The company submitted the required documentation and technical information, enabling IBSA to officially open the first certification case under the new system. The milestone demonstrates that the system has successfully progressed through concept development and regulatory approval into practical implementation. The new system is designed to provide blind and visually impaired athletes with greater confidence that equipment used in official competitions meets recognized international technical safety and quality requirements. At the same time, it establishes a transparent framework for cooperation between IBSA, manufacturers, event organizers, and athletes. The pilot phase currently focuses on goalball and blind football and will allow IBSA to gain valuable practical experience before considering expansion to additional sports and equipment categories in the future. IBSA President Iglar Ramov described the development as one of the most significant governance and technical initiatives undertaken by the Federation in recent decades. For the first time in our history, IBSA has established a structural international framework for equipment governance. This initiative strengthens athlete safety, enhances competition integrity, and reinforces the IBSA's role as the global governing body for blind sports. The opening of the first certification case confirms that the system is no longer a concept. It is now a reality. Alongside the milestone, IBSA has also published Progress Report 1 on the implementation of the Equipment Standardization, Certification, and Future Licensing System. The report provides the first comprehensive overview of the project, including its strategic objectives, approved regulatory framework, technical standards, consultation process, engagement with manufacturers, and the launch of the first certification activities. It also outlines lessons learned during the initial implementation phase and the roadmap for future development. IBSA encourages its members, athletes, manufacturers, partners, and all stakeholders to review the report and follow the continued development of this important initiative. And that'll be it tonight for me on AJ Sports. I'll hand it off to Chris to finish off the episode. Take it away, Chris.
Hello, sports listeners. Chris here, coming with a few more stories to round out our time together. First, we're going to go ahead and talk about a disabled vet who thrives in the Paralympics. Josh Sweeney, a NAMPA claimed gold medal and aids others with specialized wares. Finding a way to do competitive sports, sweat, and have an outlet for frustrations has been very transformative for NAMPA resident Josh Sweeney. And he took that outlet well beyond the hobby level, eventually becoming a Paralympic gold medalist, coach, and now builder of an adaptive sports equipment for others. The 37-year-old Marine veteran lost both his legs when he stepped on an improvised explosive device on deployment in Afghanistan in 2009. And while recovering in the hospital, he was approached by the veteran nonprofit Semper Fi and America's Fund. The nonprofit aims to help veterans and service members who were critically wounded, ill, and injured, and provided support for Sweeney's family when he was in the hospital. I think being able to give back into athletics allowed me the ability to see what I was capable of still after being injured, Sweeney said recently. I think that competitive drive is what really kept me, or keeps me, sane day to day. Sweeney scored the winning goal for the U.S. national sled hockey team to bring home the 2014 Paralympics gold medal. He still competes for Team USA in Nordic skiing and the biathlon, and coaches for those sports as well for triathletes. He also is about a year into a new adventure, running JS Sports Adaptive Sports to create customized adaptive equipment such as cross-country Nordic ski frames and mechanisms to adapt hand cycles. His business venture is also supported by Semper Fi and America's Fund. Sweeney works out in his garage, fulfilling orders for athletes from all over the U.S. and some internationally. Most people find him through word of mouth and through his involvement in so many adaptive sports settings. Sweeney recently traveled to Canada to coach a development team and around five athletes who attended used ski frames he built. A lot of adaptive equipment is very expensive, and it's also very custom, Sweeney said. So I'm trying to essentially fill the hole that's in the middle, being affordable and also provides what you need. Many athletes and nonprofits using this kind of equipment rely on grants to pay for them. His Wahoo kicker flip, which allows a hand cycle to be used as a stationary trainer, is $750. A Nordic ski fixed frame ranges upwards from $750, and a new product he just designed and began selling, an adjustable Nordic sit ski frame that starts at $1,000. Sweeney said the adjustable frame design came about because he realized there are very few frames that can adjust both up and down and the angle of the bucket seat sold in the U.S. People were having to adjust pick sizes for a fixed frame, but then once you get it, that's it, he said, and you don't truly get to explore, is this a good position for me to be skiing in, or is there a better position? That's where I think trying new things within the sport to see what happens can be beneficial. Thinking about it, this resulted in a strike of inspiration in his garage, and now he's been selling the new style of frame for about 3 months. Before running the business, Sweeney got started by trying to make equipment for himself. I always liked tinkering, but I wasn't really into making things, he said. While trying to make equipment for himself, Sweeney turned to his friends who were engineers and fabricators, who worked with him to figure out how to craft what he needed. He said those friends still help him work through tough questions. It's been a lot of tinkering and learning over the last 10 years until I finally felt like I was in a place that I could make something without feeling worried about having someone using it, Sweeney said. He recently made himself a custom kneeler so he could hand cycle the Rebecca's Private Idaho race, a multi-day gravel race in Sun Valley, for his third time. Although much of his time is spent working on fulfilling equipment orders, he's still focused on competing as well. In early January, he will be traveling to West Yellowstone to compete in the Sit Ski National Race Series and Biathlon Nationals. In February, he'll be coaching athletes at the 2025 Invictus Games in Vancouver and Whistler, Canada. He also uses the equipment to go skiing, play wheelchair basketball, and bike with his kids, who are ages 7 and 9. They'll jump on their bikes and we'll ride around the neighborhood together, he said. Being able to just make those pieces that I need to be able to do that stuff with them is really cool. Next up, giving fate the middle finger, how blind climber Jesse Dufton scaled a 500-foot monolith. As he climbed up the 500-foot rock face El Matador, wedging small pieces of metal into the rock in the hope they would catch his fall, Jesse Dufton was almost entirely alone. Over his own labored breathing, panting, and frustrated cursing, Dufton could hear the crackle in his ear of his wife and climbing partner, Molly Dufton, offering assurance and crucial guidance from the ground below. "I got you. Go on, buddy," Come on, she calmly said through the headset. Calves burning, fingers pulsing, heart in his chest. Up, Dufton went, scrambling onto tiny handholds and jamming his legs in cracks to move up the sheer wall. Born with a degenerative eye condition called cone rod dystrophy, Dufton is blind, able to see no more than a bunch of flashing lights if he were to hold his own hands up in front of his face. But that's not to say he wasn't aware of how high he was free climbing on the imposing El Matador on the aptly named Devil's Tower in Wyoming. The whizzing of birds flying underneath his feet and the gusts of wind underneath him provided telling clues. On El Matador, I wouldn't say that I was utterly terrified. Exhausted? Yes. Terrified? Not particularly, he explains. My fear level is now more correlated to the amount of danger that I perceive myself to be in. If I can be up high, but if the climbing is easy and I've got loads of gear, I'm not stressed. I'm only stressed when I think I'm going to fall off, and I'm even more stressed when the gear isn't good. Though he started climbing aged 2 with his father, by 11, Dufton had only 20% of his vision. His sight has gotten progressively worse, and now aged 39, Dufton only has light perception. He has climbed the famed Old Man of Hoy in Scotland's Orkney Islands, and also became the first blind climber to establish a multi-pitch route on a 300-foot cliff in Morocco's Lesser Atlas Mountains. It took just a day for Dufton and his wife Molly to climb El Matador, climbing the monolith's cracks, columns, and overhangs to make him the first blind climber ever to achieve the feat. Their journey is documented in the newly released Climbing Blind 2, available through Brit Rock Films. Though Dufton had hoped to on-site the route, which means climbing a route with no falls and never having watched another climber complete it, not a problem for me, he chuckles. A slip and a fall meant this was off the cards. He admits El Matador was the hardest road I have ever attempted. But rather than let his lack of eyesight limit him, Dufton continues climbing impressive and technical rock faces, he says, as a way of giving fate the middle finger. I don't want to have my genetic fate determine my life choices, he adds, musing that crossing the road on the way into the office is more dangerous, because I can't see the cars. I have no control over them. I'm literally just listening for them. In an instant, you could die. If you never take any risk, you condemn yourself to certainty of missing out. Dufton says that while climbing El Matador, he took several massive whippers, or falls, but was fine because of preparation and mitigation methods. His wife Molly tells CNN Sport that, once the hardest pitches at the beginning of the route were complete, it was almost like we were celebrating kind of a halfway up the wall. So when we got up to the top, I think it's almost a bit muted. It's obviously amazing to get on the top. She adds, I've been climbing for over 20 years myself, and I climbed to the descent level, but still, some of the stuff he gets up, it's just insane. A partnership built on trust. Dufton and his wife have spent the duration of their partnership climbing. After meeting at university 20 years ago, the pair have devised a system using a two-way radio to communicate. He climbs, and she belays him on a rope, and vice versa. If I'm leading the climb, before I leave the ground, Molly will run through the route with me, and the things you're looking for is to communicate what is the line of the route, and also, most importantly, where's the first gear going to be placed, Dufton explains. We've been doing it for a while, so it doesn't feel like that unnatural anymore, Molly says. It just kind of seems almost normal now, but at the beginning, I think you do feel a lot of extra responsibility. Obviously, you can't remember everything, so it's just kind of focused on the important bits, like where there's a big ledge where we could rest, she adds. Once he's on the wall, you don't actually say that much. He's focusing on, I'm kind of feeling the holds out. The pair have climbed over 2,000 routes together, and those, Dufton says, are just the ones they have bothered to officially log. Often people ask us whether or not we argue. No, I think we're very well matched. And also, when we're climbing, that takes up all the focus. It's pretty demanding mental activity. You've got no space for anything else, she explains. For his part, Dufton relies on feel when ascending. You pay attention to the non-visual clues more so, barking and harking back to the feeling that foot holds through your shoes. I'm super picky about shoes because that sensitivity is really important to me. That and endurance, which he describes as his superpower. My finger strength isn't that great, but my endurance is incredible, says Dufton, whose climbing has earned him support from outdoors brands like Montaigne. However, sometimes the couple systems has its limitations. Sometimes she's way down below and she just can't see. So especially on some pitches where you go around the corner or over a roof or something like that, well, the line of sight is blocked, says Dufton. She can't give you any information. That's a fairly standard occurrence. As with any high-stakes activity, there is a bond built on trust. In any kind of normal climbing, you are literally putting your life on the partner's hands, because if you fall and they don't catch you on the belay, you know, if you're up high, you're going to die, he explains. That is the fundamental part of any climbing partnership. The fact that we are life partners as well, in some ways, doesn't make that much difference, I think, because you've already committed to trusting your life to someone. Molly agrees. We're both really passionate about climbing, so it isn't like a drain on any one of us, and I almost get out of watching him succeed than my own climbing. Now let's move on to some wheelchair basketball. He doesn't have a femur, fibula, or ankle bone, but his coach thinks he can still play college basketball. A few days after Christmas, Henry Horton is making hot chocolate. His mom tries to get milk out for him, but he stops her. Get out of here, Mom, said Henry, a sophomore at Little Miami High School in Hamilton Township, Ohio. Henry was born with proximal femoral focal deficiency, as he describes the condition, which led to 8 surgeries and a prosthetic leg. He stops and laughs because he said it wrong. I don't have a femur, I don't have a fibula, and I'm also missing an ankle bone. In his bedroom, Henry plays Minecraft. Then he takes his prosthetic off and demonstrates how to put it back on. It's his 13th different one. But Henry wants people to know his leg does not define him. Not everybody understands that it's what it's like to be a disabled person, he said. They look at me and look at my leg and think I'm different. I'm really not. More than the hot chocolate his family enjoys around the holidays, Henry loves basketball. And before he started playing wheelchair basketball, he used to get compliments after every game, even if he didn't play well. Sometimes, he said, it seemed like kids let him score. Now, he plays for the Cincinnati Dragons, a wheelchair basketball team started by a Paralympian who grew up in Covington. Now, Henry has to earn these compliments. They like to foul me, he said with a smile. In a gym in the East End, Henry unloads his wheelchair and leaves his prosthetic leg near the bleachers. Another prosthetic is decorated in Chicago White Sox baseball logos. It has been huge for Henry to not be the one who's different, said Stacy Horton, his mother. And I think that it's really allowed him to grow up as an athlete and as a person. But if he graduated today, Henry couldn't play competitively at any of their region's colleges. Not because he doesn't have the ability, but because there aren't any programs. There are only a dozen or so in the entire country. It's part of the reason behind the University of Cincinnati's new adaptive sports program, which starts this spring. I love wheelchair basketball because it really is like chess, he said. Counts, Dragons coach and coordinator of UC's new program, and I feel like there's a lot of what we deal with every day in life. At a practice tournament, Counts tells Henry to pass and move. He said he'll have a better shot when he gets the ball back. I became disabled when I was 13, Counts said, and there weren't any a lot of options for kids with disabilities to play adaptive sports. He stopped playing sports until he was 19, when he found wheelchair basketball. It changed his life, because he eventually became a Paralympian for the United States wheelchair basketball team. And after that, he played professionally overseas. But when he moved back home, he was disappointed. Still no kids teams, he said, and the adult team I was on folded. So he started his own, and now he's been hired to help develop UC's new program, something he says he can't find anywhere else in the state, something he hopes he will help more students like Henry follow their dreams. All right, and for our next article, I see running as another way of helping people. He's a teacher by trade, but a keen runner outside work, and now Sam Ostermeyer wants to take his love of helping people to the next level. Mr. Ostermeyer trained to be a guide runner for blind athletes in 2019, inspired by his mom, a retired teacher of the visually impaired. Now, more than 5 years later, the Shrewsbury runner is his first race as a guide in March, and is encouraging anyone interested in to try the training. "I love running. It's my escape. I get to do that, and it's a different way of running," he said. "You get to the enjoyment out of knowing that you can help someone that hopefully you're giving confidence to." The guide runner is essentially there to be the eyes and the ears for the runner, so your job is to give them instructions to help them navigate around the course. Be aware of obstacles that they may come across. Another one is a change of terrain. So some races will go from tarmac to grass to soft land, and it's really important that they're able to anticipate and know what's coming up. The training, completed with England Athletics, involves attending a sight loss awareness and guide running workshop, along with safeguarding and first aid training. You go along, learn about what you need to do, and then you actually go out there and do the practical, which is donning some blindfolds, working together, and actually having a good old practice, said Ostermeyer. Then it's just a case of keeping up the techniques and keeping yourself refreshed. He is one of 6 registered guide runners in his local running club. "We went and did a local Shrewsbury Park run a few months back where we blindfolded each other and we practiced," he said. "It's really important to understand what it's like for the visually impaired runner that you're guiding as well. Communication is key, and having the confidence as well. You want to share that confidence with the visually impaired runner that you're running with. The quality is knowing the person you're running with and talking to that person about what their impairment is and how they like to be guided, because you're doing it for that person and not yourself. One of the best ways of communicating, I find, actually, is through touch. Not actually saying anything. It's through making contact with those arms," he said. "You can communicate just by nudging someone slightly to the left. Sometimes that's much easier than trying to give them and having really detailed instructions, which actually might be confusing. I see running as another way of helping people," he said. Mr. Ostermeyer is a contact with a man from Connack, and they have penciled in the Wolverhampton 10K in 2025, which he said he was looking forward to as his first event as a guide. He said anyone interested in learning how to be a guide should do it. "It's a great way of helping people. The running community is brilliant," he said. "There's no negativity in the running community whatsoever. And actually, this is a really positive way that you can still do your run and actually help other people to experience that community as well." You've been listening to Audio Journal Sports Page, our effort to look at sports from a different point of view. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone or iPad. This is Chris, along with Anna and Nick. If you have any information on any disabled sports and would like us to share it with our listeners, give us a call at 508-797-1117 or email info@audiojournal.org. Thank you for listening.
Hello, listeners. Would you like to hear news from Holden, Paxton, Princeton, Rutland, and Sterling that you're not likely to hear on commercial television and radio? Tune in to Audio Journal every Friday at 7 a.m. and again at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.